I want to thank the Fields Institute for inviting me to speak. It's a very great pleasure to be here today. So I want to begin by, I want to give a kind of general idea of the kind of questions that I'm interested in. So I want to begin, what do number theorists study? One of the main topics that number theorists like to consider are Diophantine equations. So I'm going to begin by saying some words about one of the most basic and important Diophantine equations in number theory, which is known as Pell's equation. It's the equation that I wrote down here, where the equation is in the variables x and y, and d is a parameter of the equation, which I'll suppose is just an integer. I mean, it's customary to assume that d is a positive integer, but I'm not going to make this assumption for my discussion. So I'll just consider that. And we're interested in solving this equation, for example, finding integer values of x and y, or eventually maybe. So let me call this equation E. And I'll denote by E of z the set of pairs x, y of integers such that this equation is satisfying this equation, so such that y squared minus dy squared equals 1. Now, you can also, if you want, to broaden your investigation a little bit. In fact, you can know this equation makes sense over any ring, and you can also, therefore, consider more general sets of solutions where now you allow x and y to belong to some given ring R. Okay, so R squared such that the same equation is satisfied. Okay, so I guess one of the main problems in general, I mean, in the study of the Diophantine equation, is to understand this solution sets, maybe as the ring varies. So understand E of Z or E of R, you know, for some specific choices, maybe of rings, maybe choices that would come up naturally in number theoretic investigations. So you might ask, why have considered this particular equation? Why is this equation so important in the development of the subject? I think a large one of the main reasons why this equation is especially interesting is because of a key algebraic structure, namely a group law, which allows us to produce new solutions to the equation from old ones. So that's a very simple thing. If I have a solution x1, y1 to that equation, and another solution x2, y2, I can produce a third solution by a binary composition law, which I'll denote by star. And that's given very explicitly by the formula x1, x2 plus d, y1, y2, x1, y2 plus y1, x2. So you can check, if I start with two solutions, what I've written down here is yet another solution to the same equation. So this was known very long. It appears to have been known to Indian mathematicians of the 12th century. And so, okay, so it follows in particular from this this group law that E of Z and E of R, in general, for any ring, are abelian groups. I mean, this group law can easily be seen to be commutative. But we have actually a much more precise statement, which is due to Fermat, who sort of took up the study of these equations in a systematic way. So Fermat proved that, in fact, this set E of Z is actually a finitely generated abelian group, and moreover, he determined its structure precisely. He gave a precise description So E of Z is isomorphic as an abelian group to the direct sum of a finite group T and a certain number of copies of Z, Z to the R, so where T is finite, and R is given by the following very simple recipe. So it's zero if the integer parameter d that appears is either negative or a perfect square of an integer z, and it's equal to one otherwise. And I mean, that's the reason why often one considers the Pell's equation for the case where this r is equal to 1, and then the situation is a bit more rich, at least from the point of view of integral solutions. So that theorem of Fermat implies, in particular, that there is a fundamental solution from which all other ones can be generated, essentially, by repeated application of this group law. So there's a fundamental solution, which one could call x naught, y naught, such that any x, y in E of Z can be written as up to sign, I guess, as x naught, y naught raised to the power k according to the group law, that star that I introduced before, where, so for some k in Z, that's for all x, y in E of Z, in the set of solutions to the Pell's equation with integer coefficients. So, of course, I mean, when you see this theorem, the first question which comes up is there actually an algorithm to produce this fundamental solution? Is there an algorithm to produce this x naught, y naught? And indeed, Fermat's method for proving this theorem is constructive. It actually exhibits. It's actually not too hard to show that this integer r is at most 1, so that the group of solutions to Pell's equation can be generated by at most one element. The difficulty is actually showing that this x naught, y naught exists. And so the answer is yes to this question. And so Fermat's method. So Fermat was actually not the first to discover this method. It was also known to Indian mathematicians a bit later, maybe I think in the 13th century or so. But he was the first to show that this method actually works all the time, and it always produces a solution. Yeah. Probably not. No, I mean, his big contribution was, anyway, so I'll maybe ask this in a short while, but I doubt that he was aware of the history, because this must have been, about 100 years ago, so yeah, I mean, of course, in those days, it wasn't. But I'll say a few words about why Fermat still deserves some credit, shortly. Yeah. So Fermat's method was what's known as the continued fraction, or what's known at least in modern days as the continued fraction method, and it's based on a very simple observation that to produce solutions to Pell's equation integers amounts to finding very good rational approximations of the square root of d. If x, y is in E of Z, then x over y is a very good rational approximation of the square root of z. In fact, in some sense, it's the best possible rational approximation, because if you square both sides, you get x squared over y squared equals d. And if you subtract that, so if you look at x squared over y squared minus d, you're going to get x squared minus dy squared over y squared. And because d, because the square root of d is irrational, we know that that numerator in this fraction cannot be zero. So the smallest it can be is 1, and that's what we want to find. Right? So then the idea is, I mean, we know how to find the best rational approximations to any given real number is to write say, a positive real number, as a so-called continued fraction expansion. Take its integer part, invert what's left over, take the integer part of that, and so on and so forth. Continue like that, and you can write, so you can express any real number as a series like that, which, if the real number is not rational, at least continues indefinitely. And then you can sort of take this infinite expansion and truncate it at the end stage, and you get a rational number, which I'll call Pn over Qn in lowest terms, by taking that continued fraction expansion and stopping at the end stage. So, the theory of these continued fraction expansions is very classical. It's been very well studied. It's actually really one of a very beautiful piece of classical number theory. And it's known that in general, so these continued fraction expansions are, in a sense, which can be made precise, the best possible rational approximations of the real number. I mean, relative to the size of the numerator and denominator. So Pn over Qn is a good rational approximation to the square root of d, and in fact, more precisely, what we can say in this context is that for some n, chosen appropriately, at some point, if you look at these convergence, the so-called convergence of the continued fraction expansion, you're going to find at some stage a solution to Pell's equation. So for some n, we're going to find that Pn squared minus dQn squared is as small as it can possibly be, namely 1 or minus 1. And moreover, the first time that happens is going to be actually a fundamental solution. So the smallest such gives a fundamental solution. So that's a very satisfying answer to the problem of generating the solutions of Pell's equation over the integers. But, of course, in number 3, one always tries to consider questions like that and generalize them, see if we can find questions which are more difficult or less well understood. And one way, as I hinted here, that we can consider this equation over arbitrary rings, the kind of rings that we like to work with in number theory are those which are finitely generated in a strong sense, in the sense that if I look at the ring just as an additive group, with forgetting about the multiplicative structure on it, then that ring is isomorphic to V to the N, so N copies of V. So in other words, I can find an integral basis for the ring. Now, those rings are sometimes called rings of generalized integers or rings of algebraic integers. Oh, yes, that's true, except that you have to know in advance, if you want to call that an algorithm, you have to know in advance that it's going to terminate.
Yes,
but that's what Fermat proves, so I'm glossing over that. But Fermat actually shows. So, in fact, he viewed this as an instance of his method of descent, which is kind of interesting, because in modern terms, we don't see it that way. But he actually proves that at some point, and he's actually quite precise about what stage this happens, you produce a solution this way, a non-trivial one.
Is it boundable as in terms of some of the other parameters?
Yes. But in a kind of subtle way.
Okay.
It varies in a rather interesting and subtle way as a function of... Okay, so we can consider these more general rings, and we still continue to have the basic result that if I now consider E of R, the set of solutions to Pell's equation with entries in these kind of more general rings, then this is still a finitely generated group. It's finitely generated. So therefore, E of R is isomorphic abstractly to a certain number of copies of Z plus a finite torsion subgroup. And we even have actually a fairly precise recipe for computing R as a function of the ring, as a function of capital R. But we still want to do, well, so what I want to do now is explain the very tantalizing analytic construction of solutions to Pell's equation, which somehow has led to a lot of modern and very deep questions and work. So I want to talk about analytic solutions to Pell's equation. So what do I mean by that? Well, you can start by noting that, so I'm going to talk about analytic solutions to Pell's equation. So if I let x be the analytic function of, say, the complex variable z, which is the hyperbolic cosine of z over square root of d, and I let y of z be its derivative, its prime of z, well, that's 1 over root d, hyperbolic sine of z over root d, then these two functions, that's very easy to check, are satisfy the Pell's equation, right? So it's certainly true that x of z squared minus dy of z squared is equal to 1. This has a little bit, I mean, you might think it has a bit of number theoretic interest, because if you write out the Taylor series of these two analytic functions, they actually have integer coefficients. So this looks like z to the 2k over d to the k, 2k factorial, something, and this one is so they look like that. So you produce a solution to the equation in power series with integer or any rational coefficients. So we can use these two functions to get an analytic description of the set of complex solutions. So I now look at the complex solutions to Pell's equation. That's not such an interesting object from a number theory point of view. It's very easy to produce complex solutions. You just take any x and c, and you have then two choices for y. But you can consider the map which to any complex number z associates the pair x of z, y of z. And that gives you a very nice parametrization of the complex solutions of E by c. I'll call that exp, because it's actually, and that's a fun exercise to check, that this exp is actually a group homomorphism where I equip C with the usual addition law and E of C with this sort of funny addition law that I gave at the beginning of my lecture. So you can check that it's actually a group homomorphism. And it has a kernel. I mean, it's the kernel is all integer multiples of 2 pi I root D because of the periodicity of the exponential. And it actually induces an analytic isomorphism between the set E of C and the group C modulo, the subgroup generated by integer multiples of 2 pi I root D, which topologically looks like a cylinder. I mean, so it's like, so that's the. So what we would like to do is to find some good values of Z. So this map, of course, is highly transcendental. So if you start with a point in C, which is, say, algebraic or rational, you have no reason to expect to get something algebraic or in E of C in general. So the question which I want to discuss is, can we produce interesting values of the parameter z for which the image of z under this exponential map is say an algebraic integer is an algebraic integer. So generate one of these rings of algebraic integers. So it turns out that a very partial insight into this question comes from a very unexpected direction. Which is to consider the Pell's equation, the original equation, but not over rings of algebraic integers or rings of complex numbers, but to consider them over finite fields. So we saw in the context of elliptic curves in the first talk today that it's very interesting to look at Diophantine equations of the natural group law and consider their structure over finite fields. Those have applications to a lot of real-world problems like cryptography. But we're going to consider the set of solutions to Pell's equations over FP, where P is a prime and FP is the finite field with P elements. Well, that's a finite group. Its structure can actually be determined precisely. It's actually a cyclic group. The main invariant of this group is its cardinality. And it's an easy fact that the cardinality of E of FP is given by the following formula. It's actually 2P if P divides D. I'm not going to concern myself much with this case. It's P minus 1 if D is not divisible by P, but is a square modulo P, is a quadratic residue modulo P, and it's P plus 1 if D is a non-square modulo P. So, in particular, you see that, except for this finite collection of primes, which are not very important, for all but finitely many primes, the number of solutions to the equation never deviates very far from P. It actually always deviates from either 1 or minus 1. So what's interesting is the error term. So I'm going to call, I'll call NP this cardinality, and I'll write, so we can always write NP equals P minus AP, where AP is 0 or plus or minus 1, and most of the time it's plus or minus 1, except for finitely many primes, which divide D. I guess P in my plus or minus 1. So, okay, so we have now a function defined on the primes. We extend it to a function defined on all the integers by forcing it to be multiplicative. So we define A sub N by taking A sub P1 to the E1, A sub PR to the ER, where P1 to the E1, PR to the ER is the factorization of N into a product of powers of primes, which is unique, the unique factorization. Now, you can see that this function, AN, a priori looks kind of subtle because it's defined, so it's defined by a condition on P, but the condition is whether when you take this fixed integer d and you reduce it mod p, whether that's a square or not. So it's not clear a priori how that condition varies with p. So if you would like to understand that function in a fairly concrete way, a priori it's not completely clear. See, it's defined by as a subtle arithmetic function involving counting the number of solutions of some fixed equation where you vary the p. But we do have a lot of control over this function, thanks to the theorem of Gauss, the following theorem of Gauss, which tells us that this function an is actually periodic. It's periodic. In fact, it even tells us what a possible period. The period is at most 4d. So an plus 4d is always equal to an. Now, this is a direct consequence of the quadratic reciprocity law that was proved by Gauss. So you see, because AP is the Legendre symbol D over P. It's it's 1 if D is a square amount of P and minus 1 if D is a non-square amount of P. But quadratic reciprocity allows us to translate this condition, which feels like a subtle condition on P, into the condition of whether P is a square of mod D, so to speak. I mean, so it's equal to this, up to a sign. And this, I mean, and the sign depends on P modulo 4. So this is clearly a periodic function of period 4D, because what P is modulo D is depends only on the value of P modulo D, and the sign depends on the value of P modulo 4. So that's the proof. So it's really quadratic reciprocity, which tells us that this counting function, when we sort of count the number of solutions to the Pellis equation, we ultimately get a very simple function of the variable P, which we can then control analytically. We can use that now to get, I mean, this theorem allows us to have a strong analytic control over, say, various generating theories we could form from these coefficients AN, which were defined a priori arithmetically. So now I'm going to write a kind of outlandish theorem which tells us that you can take these coefficients AN and package them somehow to produce in a surprising way solutions to Pell's equations via this uniformization, via this map, this exponential map. So the theorem is the following. Suppose tau is a complex number, is a rational number. It's of the form A over B, in, say, in lowest terms. And let Z be the complex number square root of D times the sum, n going from 1 to infinity. No, sorry, that didn't work. Yeah, no, sorry, I want a D here. D times sum n equals 1 to infinity, a n over n, e to the 2 pi I, n tau. So I package together the coefficients a n into a kind of Fourier series, and I evaluate at a rational argument tau. So then, the conclusion is that the image of Z under the exponential map belongs, well, a priori, it belongs to E of C, by definition, but in fact, it's algebraic, and it belongs to a very specific ring of integers, namely the ring generated over Z by a Bth root of unity, where zeta B is a Bth root of unity, an element whose Bth power is 1, and a primitive, so Z, B to the X is not equal to 1 for all X dividing B, X not equal to B. So that's the theorem. So presented like that, it looks a little bit unmotivated and strange. I mean, you see, when I start with a rational number, tau equals A over B, then of course when I take E to the 2 pi I and tau, well, I get a Bth root of unity. But this is an infinite sum, so each partial sum belongs to this ring, but that limit has no reason to still belong to the ring, and in fact it doesn't. But then, when you take a specific element and you apply the exponential to it, you land back in, you get a solution to Pell's equation over the ring Z. And it's a very tantalizing phenomenon because you're producing solutions to Diophantine equations via analytic processes. You would think naively that those processes are very ill-suited to solving Diophantine equations, because there we make this very stringent requirement that we want our solutions to be in the rationals or in some in a ring of algebraic integers. That's a very discrete kind of condition to impose, and it's very rare that naturally occurring infinite series converge to rational or integral quantities. So there's definitely some theory underlying that. I want to make a few remarks about that proof before moving on. So the first remark is that, okay, well, you might ask about the proof. The proof is not difficult. The main difficulty is in realizing that something like that should be true. So the proof is an explicit evaluation. And it involves techniques that are essentially quite elementary. I mean, I guess the deepest ingredient is this theorem here, this quadratic reciprocity. So this is something that one could do in an undergraduate number theory class, like maybe an honors class in undergraduate number theory. In fact, the proof of this statement is essentially due to Dirichlet in the 19th century. And he really saw that this method. Okay, so once you produce a solution to Pell's equation in a ring like that, you have one solution that you've produced. You can consider all its algebraic conjugates, and in fact, these algebraic conjugates are also given by analytic formulas of that kind. And then you could take the sum. I mean, the sum in the group, and then get a solution over Z. And when you do that, you always get a non-trivial solution. You don't necessarily get the fundamental solution, but you get some power of the fundamental solution, some non-trivial power. So this gives you a recipe for solving Pell's equation. It's not at all as good as the recipe that was given by Fermat. So it's not, from a computational point of view, it's a very bad one. But what Dirichlet said about this method is that he envisaged it as he wrote, c'est un beau rapprochement entre deux branches de la théorie des nombres, de la science des nombres, by which he meant number theory and analysis, that one could use the convergence, the ideas of summing infinite series, of taking limits, to actually solve Diophantine equations. Number theory analysis is a very tantalizing interaction between those two branches. So, the third remark is that this phenomenon does suggest a mystery, and even though we can prove it completely, because it can be transposed to other settings where we understand far less. So that's what I want to talk about now. It's been known, I guess this is one of the ideas which guides a lot of research on elliptic curves, that there's a very basic analogy between Pell's equation and elliptic curves. So I'm going to now talk about a second class of Diophantine equations, which has received a lot of modern attention. So an elliptic curve is simply an equation of the form y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b, as we heard already in some previous talks, where this time the coefficients, these are the parameters, a and b. We can take them to be rational if you want. So it's a bit more complicated than Pell's equation because the degree is larger. It's now a cubic equation, not a quadratic one. But we give ourselves more freedom by now considering, so I'm going to denote this again by the letter e. Before it was four equation, now it's four elliptic curve. We give ourselves more freedom by considering now not anymore the integer solutions to the equation, but the rational solutions to the equation. So I'll let E of Q be the set of x, y in Q squared, such that this equation is satisfied. And more generally, if F is any field or any ring containing AB, I can also define that in the obvious way. So we can play the same game with this equation. Why? Well, because of the group law. So, that's really the reason why there's this basic fundamental analogy between Pell's equation and elliptic curves. In the same way that if we have two solutions to Pell's equation, we can produce a third one, that's the same happens with elliptic curves. And we heard that in the first talk today in cryptography, where we saw how considering elliptic curves over finite fields gave us some tools for cryptographic applications. So, I remind you very quickly, for those of you who weren't at that talk, that geometrically, you can think of, it's best to explain the group law, to view it over the reals. So the set of of real solutions, the locus of real solutions in the Cartesian plane of this elliptic curve equation. It looks like a curve like that. If I have two points, P and Q, I can draw the line through them. And that line intersects the curve in a third point because the curve is a cubic curve. And then we reflect this point around the origin, and that's what we call, around the x-axis, and we get a point which we call P plus Q. And although that's, I explained it here geometrically over R, this is purely algebraic. You can work out the equations, and it makes sense over any ring which contains the coefficients A and B. So that's the group law. And we have the theorem of Mordell, which is the exact counterpart of that theorem of Fermat I mentioned earlier, saying that the group E of R is finitely generated when R is a finitely generated ring, a ring of integers. Namely, in this case, actually E of Q. So this is, again, it's an abelian group, but it's actually finitely generated as an abelian group. In other words, finitely generated. So E of Q is abstractly, as an abstract group, isomorphic to a certain number of copies of Z, a direct sum with a finite group T. Now, here there comes, so unlike Pell's equation, and that's a key source of both the new difficulties in the theory as well as the richness of the theory, that there is no simple recipe for describing this integer R. Well, that's a big a problem. So we have no explicit, we know that this R is finite, that there is some finite set of fundamental solutions, but the proof that was given by Mordell, and really also was based on some ideas of Fermat, in fact, has an important non-effectivity in it. So, so question, given E, can we produce an algorithm for finding, well, both the invariant R and a basis, P1 up to PR, of fundamental solutions from which essentially all the other ones can be obtained by repeated application of this group law? That's what we would like to do. And then we would consider that we understand completely the set of rational solutions to the elliptic curve equation. So this is a very big open question. It's intimately, it's essentially equivalent, really, to almost, to the Burchin-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture. So this is very closely related to the Burchin-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture, which is one of the Clay Institute Millennium Prize problems for which a prize of $1 million is offered for a solution. So anyone who could actually produce an effective algorithm for solving these equations would actually be very close to solving a question like that, or at least half of it. So there is an analog. There is a candidate algorithm which was proposed by Fermat, and it's called Fermat's descent. In fact, Fermat thought of his descent method applied to elliptic curves and the continuous fraction method for solving Pell's equation as being the same thing, essentially. But in this case, it's not known to be an algorithm. It's not known to terminate. That's the crucial issue. So let me say now something about analytic constructions of solutions. Well, so we have, we had for Pell's equation, we have an analytic description of the set of complex solutions to the elliptic curve equation. So if I look at the set of x, y with complex coordinates satisfying the elliptic curve equation, it turns out that there's the kind of analog of the exponential map, which is defined in terms of what's called the Weierstrass P function attached to E. So there's a certain analytic function of Z, which plays the role of the exponential, in this case, or rather of the hyperbolic cosine for the Pell's equation. And so we have that. We have this kind of exponential map, and we can play a game which is very similar to the one I played before, in producing this kind of funny-looking theorem. If you take some infinite series defined by, whose coefficients are defined in terms of the arithmetic behavior of the equation over various finite fields, and produce out of that analytically a solution to the original equation. So you could do the same thing for the elliptic curves. You define NP now to be the number of points, the number of solutions to the equation over the finite field with P elements, and you define AP to be the error term, P minus NP. The number, I mean, how much this deviates from somehow the expected number of solutions. And you can extend that to a function on integers, essentially by multiplicativity. I mean, so you essentially impose this kind of relation. It's a little bit more complicated than in the case of Pell's equation, because you could only impose this relation when n and m are coprime, have no divisors, no factor in common. So to define AP to the n, it's a slightly more complicated two-term recurrence. AP times A sub P to the n minus 1 minus P times AP to the n minus 2. It doesn't really matter, but I mean, there's a precise recipe. Once you know the APs, you can produce by simple formula all the ANs. So you've produced this kind of interesting arithmetic function of n by counting the number of solutions on the elliptic curve equation over a finite field. And then we have now we can consider the sum, the same series I had before, sum of a n over n e to the 2 pi I n tau. So that, of course, you have to worry a bit more about convergence. I mean, the series I wrote down here, the series I wrote down here converges at least conditionally if tau is a rational number. Here the problems are more involved because an is somewhat larger in magnitude. So it's better to restrict to arguments where the series converges absolutely. So this converges absolutely and uniformly on compact subsets if tau belongs to if tau is a complex number with strictly positive imaginary parts. Okay, so I'm going to assume that. So if tau is a strictly positive imaginary part, then obviously this is in the open unit disk, e to the 2 pi I tau, and then the power series converges. We know enough about the growth of these coefficients to guarantee that. So here's another very funny-looking statement, another outlandish theorem, that if tau, this argument, is of a very special kind, if it's an algebra, I mean, if it's an algebraic number of the form a plus b square root minus c, where b and c are positive rational numbers, and a is any rational number, then the image under the exponential map of the sum a n over n e to the 2 pi I n tau is a point, is a solution to E with algebraic coordinates. These coordinates belong, we can be more precise about the field of definition of these coordinates. They actually belong to an abelian extension of the quadratic field generated by tau. So they don't belong to Q of tau. They belong to some extension of some finite extension of Q of tau whose symmetry group is an abelian group. So it's worth comparing those two. I mean, there's clearly a strong analogy between these two results. They have very much the same flavor, but the theorem above concerning elliptic curves is a lot deeper than the one concerning Pell's equation. So let me say some words about the proof. I mean, so if you want to prove something like that, you have to somehow be able to evaluate this kind of infinite series. And the difficulty here is that the coefficients an are defined by a very arithmetic process. So it's not here clear how you could manipulate nicely this kind of series without some extra knowledge. And that is, so that the key ingredient here is the theorem of Wiles, which tells us something very deep about these coefficients, an. It doesn't really matter what it tells us, actually, from my discussion. But so what Wiles tells us is that the coefficients an are the Fourier coefficients of a cut form of weight 2. And I don't want to, you shouldn't worry about these words. So I'll just put this in quotes because I'm not going to define this. But this is the point I want to make is that this result is the exact counterpart of, I mean, plays exactly the same role in this proof as Gauss's theorem and quadratic reciprocity played in my study of Pell's equation. So it's what gives us a sort of analytic harness on the coefficients and allows the evaluation of series of this kind. So this is this was known as the Shimura-Taniyama conjecture, and it really is a kind of sophisticated generalization of quadratic reciprocity. It tells us something about the ans. It's more sophisticated to say that the ans are periodic for some period, but it has the same kind of application. And then, once you know that, you can make an explicit evaluation. And this relies on two key theories of modern 20th century number theory, the theory of modular forms and the theory of what's known as the theory of complex multiplication, which is you could consider as a branch, if you want, of the theory of modular forms. So anyway, this proof is very much a 20th century proof. It relies on objects of 20th century mathematics, most importantly modular forms and complex multiplication. So what my research has been concerned with in the past years is to try to produce conjectural generalizations of theorems of this sort. So it seems that if you don't worry, if you don't concern yourself too much with actually providing rigorous proofs, but you just stare at these kind of statements, you can somehow guess at some equally remarkable generalizations for which you don't appear to have any of the theoretical underpinnings to actually produce proofs. So that's why I want to finish my lecture. I mean, so there seem to be this kind of result seems to lead in very rich directions because there seem to be conjectural extensions of these phenomena. I mean, the phenomena covered in these two results that I stated here, whose proof cannot be attacked ostensibly by the methods of the theory of complex multiplication by these 20th century techniques. So it's the hope is that by understanding very well these phenomena, at least on a conjectural level, one could try to guess at what kind of interesting 21st century mathematics would be involved in shedding light on those generalizations. And so that's been the direction in which I've been thinking in the last years. So I'll stop here. Thank you.